Happy Labor Day, everyone. That is when we are recording on September 7th, 2020. No Filter Sports. Eli Zarrett, Bob Page, Denny McClain coming at you today. I want to talk about the Tigers and so much more going on in sports. Got college football started over the weekend. We got the Battle of Ann Arbor between Mark Schlissel, the president, and Jim Harbaugh, the coach. They haven't talked to each other, but they're on opposite tracks here in terms of getting football back. And also, I think we should really start by mentioning the death of one of the great players of all time.
And we should also mention the life of one of the great Detroit players of all time, Ernie Witt, who's going to come up as the guest on our show today.
Yes, we're going to have Ernie Witt a little bit later. But before we get into the Lou Brock thing, Bob, last week, last show, we had a really good obituary going for Tom Seaver. Then at the very end, you said what a jerk he was. So why don't you give your Lou Brock negativity first about what an asshole he was, and then we can get into the rest of his career.
Now, I will remind you of what Joe Falls wrote in the great Joe Falls. I know Denny didn't
the
like
great
him
Joe Falls.
I know you didn't like
him.
He was great about Joe Falls. I understand that. But anyway, I'll remind you what Joe wrote when Thurman Munson was killed in his tragic plane crash. He wrote in the Sporting News, where does it say that when someone dies, we only say good things about them? Thurman Munson was a jerk. I'm not happy he's dead, but that doesn't change the fact that he was a jerk. I just mentioned this about Seaver, and I mentioned that maybe Al Kaline wasn't exactly Mr. Warmth to most of us either. So I was trying to think over the weekend when I saw that Lou had unfortunately passed away at 81, if I'd ever actually met him. I interviewed Kurt Flood a number of times. Great guy. A terrific guy. I don't know if I've ever met Lou, but I'll tell you. My favorite Lou story was
– question.
Go ahead.
You ever had 500 people in your front yard on your porch?
400.
Sure you have. You know what? That happened a lot to me, to other players, and that's okay. It's very flattering to say the least. But you know what? When it happens at midnight, 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, it gets to be a little silly and frightening. And
what is that you're talking about?
I'm talking about
why some of these guys have a negative attitude. I mean, Al Kaline couldn't go anywhere without 500 people wanting his autograph. So could the catcher that with the Yankees. I mean, listen, these guys had, and you know what? Think about this. Our catcher here we're talking about played in New York. Is there any worse city to play in and great city to play in than the city of New York? If you're successful, you're a monster. If you're not, things aren't so good there.
I'm going to mention one name to you then, Denny. The greatest guy anybody ever met who couldn't poke his head or his big nose out of his house without being harassed. And I'm talking about Wayne Gretzky, greatest guy ever. You want Wayne to sign up. You are great with fans, Denny. You're great with fans. You go to your card shows, at least you did when you could.
Sure.
No fan has ever said a bad word about Denny McClain at a card show. You're friendly. You're nice. And as Dick Vitale always said, always remember, it's nice to be important, but it's important to be nice.
Yes, it is.
It's not that big a deal.
Only thing I'm saying is that you met Seaver one time.
No, I didn't. I knew Seaver in New York. Remember, I worked in New York a long time. I knew Seaver here in New York, where I am now, by the way.
Anyway, Lou Brock, regardless of what anybody who didn't like him might say about him, was one of the greatest players of all time, a game-changing guy, and very intimately involved with the Tigers and the fact that they played in the 68 World Series. But, the Cardinals were one of the first teams to really use a lot of black players. Flood, Bob Gibson, Brock. There are many others. They had Hispanics and Julian Javier.
Bill White. Bill White, the first baseman.
Bill White, yes. So many, and he was part of that Brock of those speed based pitching based cards where one run made a difference. And he was the greatest base stealer of all time. In fact, they named the award after him in the National League when he was still playing back in 1978. Interestingly, in the bio that I read, here's one sentence. He had a record tying 13 hits in the 68 World Series, and in game 4 homered, tripled and doubled as the Cardinals trounced Detroit and 31 game winner, Denny McClain. 10-1, so you wound up.
Why do you find that so funny?
Why do you find that so funny?
I don't understand. By the way, as I told Gibson one day, all this adulation I hear about you, all of these great strikeouts you had and all these shutouts you had, you guys lost. We won. Nobody's talking about us. That was the toughest thing.
And then the other thing you said was, I would not trade one Bob Gibson for 12 Mickey Loliches.
That's exactly right.
And you've been
trying
to back that off for a long time, haven't you?
Did you say that?
He said that. In fact, you know what, Danny, your buddy, Iffy the Dopester, sent me this very morning via Twitter a huge feature story on Ray Oiler, who had just gone to Seattle, and the headline is "My Roommate Danny McLean." And Oiler was trying to get your ass out of that brouhaha that you got. It was written by Jerry Green, by the way, the legendary Detroit news sports writer. One of the things I loved about this, he says, Danny and I used to lie awake in bed at night as roommates. We'd be in the dark and we'd be talking, and so I would say to Danny, how would you get me out if I actually were ever to face you? And Danny would say, well, and then Oiler would say, no, I would wait for your fastball. I would never let you throw me a breaking ball. I'd wait. Ray Oiler couldn't hit me.
Ray what was coming. Listen, Ray, I don't know how far I'm going to take what I'm about to say, but Ray Oiler had a fetish. And Ray was a funny guy. You know, as we all know, he was an alcoholic. And started his day off with a gin and tonic or a beer every day. But at night, he used to go out and prowl. And he had a fetish for, I'm not going to go much further than what I'm going to say. He had a fetish for older women. I'm not talking 40. I'm not talking 50. I'm not talking 60.
No.
I'm talking 60 plus, 65.
You mean granny porn. They have a name for that on the porn
site. You know
what? Granny porn.
It was unbelievable.
You'd know.
The first time he did it and did that in our room, I almost burnt my fingers off trying to see what the hell he was doing. He was so funny. But drinking that gin and tonic the first thing in the morning, I just couldn't believe it. And I'll tell you one thing. Until he drank the gin and tonic, he couldn't have found his ass with both hands.
Needless to say, in the 68 World Series, Brock made the infamous mistake of not sliding. Fifth inning, game five, cards up 3-2, would have put him up 4-2. Willie Horton generally taken out for a late game replacement, and defense was still in the fifth inning. Julian Javier singled, and Willie made the amazing throw home. Don Wirt faked the cutoff, and they got Brock at the plate. But apparently Brock purposely didn't slide at home. They said he did that to draw more throws, and he did that time, and it cost him a series.
Remember, you also had a former University of Michigan football player named Bill Freehand, who was 6'3 and 240 standing there blocking his way. So maybe try to do that. And Doug Harvey, of course, his nickname was God, made the call. And to this day, any angle we've seen of that play, you can't tell.
He was out. It wasn't even close.
You can't tell,
for God's sakes. He was out by a foot or two.
Yeah.
Listen, one other quick story.
What? Come on.
About him, about him and Ricky Henderson. He and Ricky Henderson got together before Henderson actually surpassed him with the stolen bases. And they wrote a poem together, by the way, a nice, lengthy little poem, about 20, 30 seconds. And what it was supposed to talk about was what Brock did, along with Henderson going ahead and surpassing the thing. Well, as we all know now, what Henderson did was when he got to third base, he picked up the bag and said, I am the greatest of all. So when Brock saw him a couple of days later after the ball game, he said, what happened to the poem? He said, oh, I forgot. And I said, it wasn't the right moment.
He said,
my favorite Brock story. Have you guys ever seen a dark-skinned black man turn red? So Brock is a guest on the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. He's on with my personal hero, Don Rickles. Rickles has already done his shtick. He's sitting there with Ed McMahon. They bring Brock out, and all Rickles went nuts over the stolen base thing. He finally gets up. He picks a pillow up off the couch. He throws it on the floor, and Rickles actually slides into the couch. It was funny. Go on YouTube. You got to see this. The funniest damn thing you've ever seen. And Brock was just laughing his ass off and so embarrassed.
I will say one thing about Brock, too. I did a lot of shows with him, with a lot of the Cardinals, as a matter of fact, for obviously the relationship between the 68 both teams. And Brock was never, ever, ever short with anybody. He shaked everybody's hands. He spent time with people. He was as good as they come, and then later became an ordained minister, he and his wife.
Uh-huh.
So they believed in a lot of good things. They did a lot of good things off the field.
Yeah.
And that's what he should be remembered for, too.
Well, that's good. Eli, did you mention, my headsets were blipping out a little bit, what Lou Brock hit in the 1968 World Series versus McLean, Lolich, and company? You know what he hit?
Here we go again.
91 of the postseason, but I don't know what
Lou Brock in the 1968 World Series only hit .464 against the Tigers, and he stole seven bases in the seven game series.
And they lost.
Yeah,
he
made a bad throw too. He threw I don't know what he did. He threw behind the runner or something,
yeah,
and cost him a run. Yeah. But you know, in 1964, in the peak of my young geekdom as a sports fan, the trade of Brock from the Cubs to the Cardinals for, I think he'd been the rookie pitcher of the year, Ernie Broglio.
He wasn't a rookie.
Yeah. Brent Musburger apparently was just out of college when the trade was made. He started writing, I guess, in Chicago. It was his first assignment, Brock said, and the content of the interview led to a headline in the paper, Cubs pull off the greatest steal since the Brinks robbery. And it's true. He'd been batting .251 with the Cubs, and he was traded in 64, hit .348 the rest of the way.
And then many years later, you guys remember reading those and they were fantastic. Bill James baseball abstracts, where James would do his commentary about players.
Right.
It was so funny and so entertaining. So one year, our buddy, our boy, Larry Sorensen, is of course in the baseball abstract, and Bill James is going to write about him. He wrote one sentence, one pithy sentence, the new Ernie Broglio. All he wrote about Larry.
That's ugly. Let's talk about the Tigers.
Current Tigers, yeah.
Yeah. So they've lost 3 out of 4 in Minnesota. Game 5 of this crucial series, you could call it, takes place today. So we're not going to know the results. It's this afternoon in Game 5. Michael Fulmer pitches, but they've lost 3 of the 4. And kind of a shame, because they pitched pretty well in the first three, losing 2-0, 3-2, and 4-3. And by the way, did you guys take notice that the first three games of this series, for the first and possibly the last time in baseball history, the first game lasted 7 innings, the second game lasted 8 innings, and the third game lasted 9 innings. So 3 games in a row, all with different innings of results, only because of this insane rules changes in the pandemic with the runner going to second base.
But that's what's been going on all year. They've been playing 7-inning doubleheaders.
I know, but the thing that... Okay, I just made a historical note there. 7, 8, 9 innings. Usually games are 9 innings, generally, and these until this year.
You know, I think as far as things go historically, that would probably be the last one you would add.
Okay, that's fine. It was the first thing I added.
Denny's boy, Matthew Boyd, looked pretty good on Friday night. Actually, he went the distance in a shot.
My boy is Mize.
Yeah, I understand that. Well, you're beating him up pretty bad, too.
Well, you know what? Anytime you start throwing the ball in the middle of the plate, up in the strike zone, and the ball has no movement.
No movement.
No one's teaching him how to pitch. He's going to get his brains beat out. And this continues to be. And unless somebody gets a hold of this kid and teaches him how to pitch, we're in for a long, and so are the Tigers, in for a long time, because this can't last. I mean, what he really needs is he needs a pitch on a regular basis in Toledo, Uganda, someplace that you can let him go out there without any pressure and just go ahead and do his thing.
He needs to go to the bullpen, Danny. He needs to go to the bullpen.
The bullpen will not straighten him out. Competition will straighten him out.
Well, if he pitches every day out of the bullpen for an inning or two, that's going to help him.
No.
Will it help the Tigers in the pennant race is the question?
Yeah, you better believe it would help the Tigers.
Why would it help the Tigers?
Because the kid's not winning, Eli. Get him out of the starting rotation.
Then don't pitch him at all.
To the bullpen.
Excuse me.
He hasn't been terrible.
Time out.
He hasn't been unbelievably bad.
Bob, it's the stretch run.
Yes.
They're 18-20. They've played 38 and only have 22 games left. They are right in the playoff hunt. In fact, they are battling for 8th place, which will get you into the playoffs.
Right.
They are 18-20. The two teams in front of them are 19-21, the Orioles, and another team that's 21-19. It's the Yankees, 21-19. So they're right there in the chase. I think they really need to try and win ball games, and that's what I think they're trying to do.
You know, I agree with you 100%.
The problem is you can't send him down to the minor leagues because the minor leagues aren't playing this year.
That's just Casey Mize. I agree with you 100%, and I'm sitting here scratching my head. They got to win ball games. So here we are, as George used to say, went to extra innings. And they bring in Joe Jimenez with a 10.6 ERA for the 8th inning. Runner on second to start the game, of course. Jimenez blew the game, and the Tigers lost 3-2. They swept the doubleheader. You look at some of the guys coming into the lineup now, and you think, is this the Tigers' best lineup they can do? It's like they're just looking at some of these minor kids, hoping they might, you know, throw something up on the wall that would stick in the proverbial sense.
Don't forget, they're showcasing some of these kids to make a trade sometime later on. That's what a lot of these kids are all about right now.
This is not the time to do it. As Eli says, they're trying to win games. They should be.
I don't think they understand and realize that they're not close. I think they know that they don't believe that they're going to make the playoffs. I just don't think they believe that.
I don't know, and
you know what? It just doesn't resemble a team. It's just like punching in a little bit of cement here,
We don't agree with you.
I don't get that at all. Did you see what happened to Jimenez on Saturday when he gave up the home run to Sano? And afterwards, Sano homered and pimped him. How does it go? Let me see how this exactly went. Sano mugged after the home run and stared at Jimenez and took his time going around the base because it's called pimping a homer. I didn't know that that was the term, pimping a home run. And because Jimenez had previously, according to Sano, celebrated after striking him out in the game in 2019 and then did the same against Nelson Cruz. Of course, it's a lie. Jimenez says, I would never show anybody up. But this is the little battles in baseball, Denny, that I just don't get, because it seems like guys preen on home runs, and what's preening too much? What's not preening enough? Can you flip the bat? Can you stare for a second, but not 2 seconds? I don't get this psychological warfare between pitchers and hitters.
When they started allowing all of the little bit of showmanships around home plate and guys standing there and watching to see how far they hit the ball, they created a little negative environment there between a pitcher and everybody else. And, you know, it's the good guys don't do it, but the guys who are hot dogs, they do it. And they like to watch their home runs go out of the park. You know,
so it's also a cultural thing. You played against him, Denny, but when Eli and I were kids coming up, there was a first baseman named Vic Power played for the Indians. Yeah. What a hot dog. All around the bag, anytime he caught a ball or whatever. So it could be a cultural thing that maybe some of us just don't quite understand. It doesn't really bother me as much as it does Eli. But I'll tell you, on Saturday, after the amazing Victor Reyes led off the game with another home run, what a job Al Avila did finding him. So here comes your boy, Sanu. He comes up facing Tarek Skubal in the second inning, and I saw the Twins broadcast. And so Dick Bremer mentions Sanu had been up 122 times so far this year, and he'd struck out 61 of them. Struck out 50% of the time. He also had 8 home runs. Denny, what's going on with baseball? No, it's strikeout or home run?
Well, I keep saying that this isn't going to make much sense, but I keep saying that the pitching is terrible, but the hitting is worse. And when you got a guy striking out 61 out of 100 times, what does that tell you? The kid is being showcased for somebody, probably. They're trying to hope he goes 4 for 4 one day, and they grab him, take him out of the lineup, and they'll leave him on the bench until somebody comes along. Oh, man, he went 4 for 4. So I don't know. I just don't know. I don't know if they're not taking enough batting practice. There's a lot of things that have been changed this year as far as working out before a ball game. So maybe some of that's got to do with it. But I know one thing. The instruction is short right now, and they're just not getting the information and the advice that they used to get.
I'd like to say that, and I haven't said this for many, many years, I really like this Tiger team. There's guys on here, like Bob just mentioned, Reyes, you know, drafted in 2012 by Atlanta. Finally now, I mean, 8 years later, starting to look like a really good player. How about Willie Castro?
Yeah.
Willie Castro, 2-run shot in the 6th to make it 6-4. Here's another guy who has struggled. Their draft choice, played for 8 different minor league teams years and years and years. I think that's great too. And the trade we've talked about for J.D. Martinez has not gone well to this point. They got Dalwell Lugo, who they've given up on. Jose King, he's just 21, though. He's still an A-ball, just 21 in Connecticut. But Sergio, why do they call it Alcantara when it's Alcantara? But in any way, Alcantara.
The accent mark in a Spanish name or word Alcantara tells you how to pronounce it.
Second syllable, Alcantara. Anyway, he hit his first major league home run on the second pitch he ever faced. And here's what it sounded like yesterday.
Drives one to deep left. Back goes Rosario. It's gone! A leadoff major league debut solo bomb for Sergio Alcantara. Welcome to the big leagues.
So who knows? We've now gone from saying allegedly that Al Avila wasn't doing the job to now saying, he's a visionary.
Yeah, well, and here's another name you forgot to mention, because I've been ripping Avila for this and saying this guy's not a major league ball player. Yeah, get rid of him. Jaime Candelario. Candelario's been terrific.
Terrific.
And you got Torkelson coming up right behind him at first base.
Brandon, please help us with the pronunciation.
I have a question for Bob. When you go to Taco Bell, do you say, I would like a chalupa? Or do you
yo no como a Taco Bell, señor. Lo siento. I don't eat a Taco Bell, buddy.
Well, I'm pretty sure SNL does.
When I go to a Mexican restaurant, in Spanish? Yes, I order in Spanish at a Mexican restaurant.
Oh, but look, I don't eat a Taco
Bell. This is a big deal with you guys, isn't it?
Let me add one thing. Let me add one thing to this
heist. Now he's a food elitist. Go ahead.
Let me add one thing to this heist. I'm really
getting a lot of criticism.
God almighty.
I got to go to some specious topics,
hey,
too.
Hey, Mary, let me lead us in prayer for a minute here. The bottom line is I said the last show that I liked what I was seeing on the field. The pitching is what is really suspect. And, of course, they have a pretty good weekend keeping the ball in the ballpark. But you know what? I just don't feel good about them. I feel uncomfortable about the ball club. And I'm not sure if they play the game well. That's all.
I think this, Denny. Eli broached a very interesting thought here on the last program. When you look at how close they were in the standings, now they get five games against their arch-rival Twins, you think, well, they can really make a statement by winning four of them. They lose the first three. If they didn't win that game on Sunday, and I'm going to take it a step further, if they don't win Monday afternoon with Fulmer on the mound, this is going to be trouble for them. You can't lose four out of five in Minnesota.
They had lost four in a row. Hey, Dr. Yaldo is doing some great surgeries like he's always done, but he's back in business now that the COVID restrictions have been let up. And tens of thousands of Detroiters in the past are now leading to a very strong showing since the pandemic ban was ended, and he has done so many surgeries over the years, over 30,000. That's why people are lined up to get better than 20/20 vision without glasses and contacts. You get custom LASIK, the best in the world. He has it right here. No one has any better or at a better price. And if you're over 45, get those multifocal lens implants like I did. You'll see the microscopic print. No need for reading glasses anymore. It's a free evaluation. Find out what procedure will change your life. Yes, to think you can see better without glasses and contacts than you ever did with them is hard to imagine. That's why go check it out. Call 1-800-398-EYES. Get that free evaluation. Go to YaldoEyeCenter.com. Tell them No Filter Sports sent you for more special discounts. $1,500 off, in fact, if you mention No Filter Sports. And for Star Lincoln, another favorite business of mine, we know about luxury cars and Lincoln's legacy of luxury, and no better than Hoot McInerney's Star Lincoln, a great family business. Just played golf with Jimmy McInerney the other day. A great family, and that's how the business is represented by them, with great service, great prices. The entire experience is something that you will remember. So give them a call. I've gotten six cars from Detroit, from Star, the Detroit's premier Lincoln dealership. You can make an appointment for specialized service at 248-354-4900 or by effortlessly online at starlincoln.com. You're listening to the No Filter Sports Podcast.
Well, here's a segue for you, Eli, since you just brought up the word golf. Again, as you folks are hearing this program, most of this stuff is over. Fulmer started at Minnesota, so on and so forth. But if Dustin Johnson, five-shot
last
lead,
day today, you're right, last date of the...
And the thing about it is, if he wins this FedEx Championship thing today, first prize for him, $15 million. $15 million.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing, the money in golf and everything. You guys have been watching this, I'm sure, the golf tournament.
It's been $10 million a year for the last 10 years, so they bumped it up to $15 this year. I don't know, without any spectators.
That's great walking around money, I'll tell you.
Just wonder where all the money comes from, but he's just an amazing number one. It's funny, I saw Phil Mickelson. Now, I've told you before on this show, I have a lot of friends who know PGA players more than I do, and some of them even house caddies when they come to town, the events at Oakland Hills or whatever. They will house some of the caddies, so they get inside information on what people think about the various players, what they're like, how smart they are, not. And Dustin Johnson, who seems like a fine guy, also has a reputation of not being particularly smart. You can tell that by listening to his interviews. And Phil Mickelson, so the reason I'm reading, Phil Mickelson was on Faraday's show.
Speaking of not particularly smart, right?
Why would you say that?
Why would you say that?
One of the greatest quotes in the history of sports. I'm such an idiot.
Why does
Phil Mickelson, when he blew the U.S. Open in New York.
Well, Phil Mickelson is obviously a very, very smart guy. And
I answered your question, though, didn't I?
I don't even know what you're talking about.
Of course you don't. Have another cup of coffee.
You
said, why would I say that about Phil Mickelson? I answered your question.
Why would you say that?
You guys are unbelievable.
I see. Okay, because he called himself an idiot once, which means he's saying I'm not very smart. Okay, I missed that little that very little stab at humor. In any case, he said on the Faraday show, which I started saying a couple of minutes ago, he said on the Faraday show, to be great at golf, you have to be very, very smart or very dumb. And so that's where I was going with the Dustin Johnson comment. Okay, let's move on from that and talk about
college. Well, how did you guys like the Michigan-Washington game Saturday and Mel Tucker's debut at Michigan State against Northwestern? Oh, you didn't watch? No. Oh, neither did we. No, I forgot to watch myself.
I did watch some college football. I found it very depressing to watch the SMU game. By the way, SMU played. Who'd they beat? Texas State. And very, very sterile, just like all of college football will be this year. Of course, you get caught up in the rivalries and all that, I suppose. But with no fans there, they had some fans spread out, so they did some social distancing, but no sideline reporters, no cheering, no cheerleaders, no mascots, none of that. And then SMU was not going to play next week because TCU had to cancel their game next week because of COVID breakouts on campus. Yeah. So there were eight games, supposed to be 10, a couple of them canceled. It's, you know, This whole college football thing now is so bizarre. You know, college football is really the ultimate sports passion play, right? It's a mishmash of Americana. You got the one side, the student athlete myth of the all-American boy giving his best for Old State U, and it always has clashed with the multi-billion-dollar grab of college of intercollegiate sports. And now with the struggle behind the scenes, whether the Big Ten is going to play or not play. And yesterday, Jim Harbaugh and a group of players and parents are marching up
Saturday,
State Street,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
up
mm-hmm.
State Street. Yeah. And the president, Mark Schlissel, is one of the most, I want to say the most outspoken, but he hasn't spoken at all. But he apparently is the one leading the charge to not let Michigan play. And he's an immunologist. And so here you've got Michigan, saying we want to play, we deserve to play. Dylan McCaffrey, they gave us a schedule. We were all set. We had zero tests or zero cases of COVID with all the tests. We're doing everything that you're supposed to do. And then the season just gets stripped from it. So we're here to vent and hopefully something changes. The same thing several other players said. And yet Schlissel is not only is he holding firm on this, but not a bargaining chip, but the threat that he will withhold the Ohio State-Michigan game scheduled for October if the Big Ten decides to go back and play. He's
an Ivy League guy. That's where he belongs. He's utterly clueless, despite obviously
being someone
who's
very... What do you mean? Why is he clueless? Right. Why is he clueless? Because he's doing something right? Because
he played it safe.
He's clueless for these reasons.
Because he's trying to keep people safe and healthy and what have you.
Right,
is that clueless?
So, well,
I think
amazing
that's pretty good.
About
how do you feel about Dr. Fucci? How do you like him?
It's Fauci. That's not even his name.
Okay. I call him Fucci. I call him a lot of things.
So at any rate, about an hour from where I speak to you today, West Point, I hope you guys have seen a game at West Point. It's an amazing experience. On Saturday, Sandon McCoy ran for 3 touchdowns. Army routed Middle Tennessee 42-0. Not only did they play, but 4,300 Army cadets were allowed inside 38,000-seat Mikey Stadium. Of course, there was a little bit of social distancing or whatever. I don't want to get into the COVID thing with you guys again, but it's just too bad what's going on. How certain conferences think we could play, we're going to be fine. And others think, no, we can't do that. In the meantime, the beat goes on with respect to the employees. The NCAA has announced it'll furlough its entire Indianapolis-based staff of 600 people 3 to 8 weeks in a cost-saving move. The furloughs will not affect senior executives, of course not. And Michigan Athletic Director Ward Manuel said last week that the U of M's athletic department is laying off 21 people. Sayonara. Good luck.
Bob, 180,000 people have now died. That's number one. And number two, there's 31 colleges right now that have had at least 1,000 kids test positive. At least 30 colleges that I'm aware of.
How many died? So, how many have died?
What does that mean? Let's hope to God not. Let's pray that they do not die.
You're right.
I'm not going to get into this with you guys.
Denny, you got to understand, there's no danger from COVID. It can't hurt anybody if you're under 25 and play football.
Oh, that's right.
Nothing to worry about. You're going to be perfectly fine. It's all a bunch of hype from guys like Mark Schlissel. Okay, Bob, we get that. Totally. Now,
good. Okay.
What I find very, very interesting is the response. And now Clemson, by the way, starts next Saturday. Yeah. And I tell you, I really like Trevor Lawrence, although he reminds me of Spicoli on Fast Times at Ridgemont High. Looks just like Sean Penn did in the movie. I can't help but think of that when I see him. Got a lot of regard for this kid. Now understand, okay, that South Carolina, where Clemson is, voted for Trump over Hillary by 14 points. It's a very red state. And yet here you've got Lawrence and the Clemson football team listing along with many others, because there was the let us play and the other right. United athlete things coming together, saying the 5-point thing that is 5 goals, ensure all teammates are registered to vote and have November 3 free from athletic obligations. Further discussions with you presidents and administrators to raise awareness about racial injustice, create community outreach activities, including food, school supplies and stuff to people that to help communities hold routine. So here you got them being very proactive in something that is being, at least, although it should be a humanitarian thing, being pushed on Democrats. And, you know, I give credit, as I said to the last show, I said athletes, and I mentioned Gary Danielson, who never played with a black athlete, got to Purdue and changed his whole vision of black-white relationships when he saw how hard his black teammates practice. So in football and sports, one of the beautiful things we've always attributed to it is that it's universal. Black, white, doesn't matter. If you're a good teammate, you play hard. Right. We are brothers in this. And I tell you, I was blown away when I saw Kirk Herbstreit the other day, and this was not acting. This was deeply sentimental. Talking about what I'd mentioned with the whole stuff in Kenosha, that it isn't just the Jacob Blakes. It's the everyday, if you're a black man in America who seems to be doing well to do, you are suspicious. Here is what Kirk Herbstreit had to say on ESPN over the weekend.
The black community is hurting. If you've listened, how do you listen to these stories and not feel pain and not want to help? You know what I mean? It's like wearing a hoodie and putting your hands at 10 and 2. Oh God, I better look out because I'm wearing Nike gear. Like, what are we talking about? And so you can't relate to that if you're white, but you can listen and you can try to help. Because this is not okay. It's just not. We got to do better, man. We got to like lock arm in arm and be together.
Some of us have always been together. Some of us have. I mean, we've played with guys. We've lived with guys. We've had a great time with guys. Black, white, green, or yellow. It makes no difference. But what I don't understand, excuse me for being a little hardcore at this, but I don't get it. Everybody who goes on TV today has to cry. I don't get it. Can't they just talk and write their notes down?
That's because you
down?
Watch soap operas all day long. That's why everybody seems to be crying on TV.
But simply, it is crazy. I mean, everybody who goes on, they want to cry. Yeah. At least, and nobody brings hankies with them.
Wait a minute.
Nobody.
Why did they say they want to cry? Maybe he are you saying he wanted to cry? I don't think he wanted to cry.
I think so. Saying he I'm planned sorry. It. And I like Herb. I think Herb's a good guy. Herbie. But you know what?
Herbie.
I mean, we don't need – I mean, I'm not accusing him of acting. But I'm sorry, everybody that goes on has got tears like alligators.
And the thing that bugged me about that soundbite, he committed a cardinal sin in his opening sentence. The black community. Philly. So Clarence Thomas and Jason
Woodlock
are part of the same community as Snoopy Dogg.
Stop.
Okay, all right, you guys. You say the same stuff all over the time, over again all the time, but I can't. It's his usual beat up on Bob today.
No. You just say
beat up on Bob.
There is no black community.
Don't give me an opportunity to beat up on Bob.
You're not quick enough to catch me.
Oh, boy.
No, you're
not. I'll trap you.
Just don't sit on me. That would be a favorite.
Really?
And hey, so guess what? Now we're going to see some more in evidence of this coming up, I think, but we don't know to what degree. Thursday night, this Thursday night, folks, is the opening game of the NFL season. Televised coast to coast.
Right?
What kind of demonstrations are we going to have? I don't know.
There may be some, you know. There may
be some. There'll be some out there. There'll be some. I mean, look what they had at the Kentucky Derby. It's you know, listen, I'm only glad that nobody got shot and killed at the Derby, because it certainly looked like it could have happened.
It did, didn't
somebody
it?
Somebody did so, get killed?
Did the guy get
no,
killed?
No. I said it looked like, I'm agreeing with you, it looked like something
it did
bad
look
was really
like
going to happen.
Yeah.
I got one for our producer, director, Brandon McAfee, because he's the guy to ask about this stuff. Over the weekend, the NFL signed a very big name as a free agent, running back Adrian Peterson. Brandon,
I'm sorry. Who are the FLs? Who are the FLs? I lost track.
The F-ing Lions.
Oh, okay. I get it. Okay.
Yeah. If you finally get that, huh?
I don't know.
Brandon, what do you think about that signing?
I don't see why they needed him, to tell you the truth. I was looking forward to seeing a nice duo with Kerryon Johnson and DeAndre Swift. And to me, Adrian Peterson's just going to take the ball out of their hands. But I guess you couldn't ever have enough depth. But I just think Adrian Peterson's on the tail end of his career. I didn't think he was needed.
Well, yeah, he is on the tail end of a career, but he's still viable. He's still threatening. I mean, listen, the guy can pick up a couple, 2-3 yards every time you give him the ball. So give him a chance. I mean, he's liable to, you know, listen, you never know who's going to be the deciding factor to get us into the playoffs once in a while. And what do we play the Lions this Sunday, right?
Do they start
play the Lions? You mean the Bears play the Lions? I don't know who the Lions
are. Yeah, right? It's this Sunday. But here I got the worst news in my life almost the other day. I found out that Trubisky. I call Trubisky because he is a Booski. He is a Booski. He has been told that he is the number one quarterback on the Bears. I am never going to bet the Bears again in my entire life. This is the worst call in the world.
Meanwhile, Tennessee certainly improved itself. They signed Jadeveon Clowney. Yeah. Did you guys see one of the main reasons why they signed Jadeveon Clowney? Taylor Lewan. A lot of players started lobbying for him on Twitter, and Taylor noted in his Twitter account that Clowney had a field day against him in a big bowl game when they played in college when Taylor was at Michigan.
Yeah.
So he wrote on Thursday, we can do this to other people's teams now.
Who was the back that, Brandon, you'll remember, was it Evans? Who was the back that Clowney just clobbered?
Oh, I remember that. Oh, yeah. Brandon would know that.
Let me go back to, if I can go back just for a second here. The Lions, they haven't really made it clear what the injuries have been to their running backs, whether it's Kerryon, DeAndre Swift, or Bo Scarborough, all missed time in the preseason. So we don't know how serious those injuries are. Right. I really believe that Adrian Peterson realizes now he's not going to run the ball all the time, may not run the ball at all. He's strictly insurance for these guys. So I don't think you can count on Adrian Peterson being the Lions lead back this season, unless the injuries are as bad as we think.
So Eli, did you see this story that it was quite hysterical when former Lions quarterback Dan Orlovsky went on Chris Long's podcast the other day? Chris Long asked him a question. He says, you were in Detroit. What was the most dysfunctional thing that you saw there? And Orlovsky says, how much time you got? Then Orlovsky said, and this is a quote, there were a couple times when I was the backup quarterback in Detroit. The offensive coordinator would call the play into me on the headset. Then I would relay it to our starting quarterback. The series is starting. We trot out for the first down. And there's nothing in my headset. I don't have a play call. Our offensive coordinator at the time, and I found out later, that's Jim Coletto. Our offensive coordinator had fallen asleep in the booth. Our guys are on the field waiting for a play call, and all you actually could hear was snoring.
That's impossible.
Fell asleep in the middle of an NFL game while we had the ball as the play caller.
And if that's true, that must have been a real boring game.
Yeah, or he must have had a really bad night.
Or an 0-16 season.
Was he running around with
Is that the 0-16 season, you said?
I mean, I imagine. Wasn't Coletto the...
Yeah, it could have been.
I think it was. But by the way, you know, Muddy used to fall asleep all the time in meetings. Muddy was head coach at Michigan State. He had narcolepsy. That was his excuse, Muddy Waters. This guy, Coletto, I don't know what happened. He's 75 now.
I was reading one of the preseason analyses. The season's getting ready to start. It's actually the New York Times. They had a rundown on every team. And here's what they said about the Lions. Key move, signing linebacker Jamie Collins, but they were 3-12-1, as you know, last year. Slay, Harrison gone. Here's his quote. Quote, it wouldn't be ridiculous to suggest that the team could improve, but the Lions are a hard team to believe in. So that seems to be the general consensus out there. Bob, why don't you bang out a couple spots here? We got much more to do, including Ernie Witt coming up. But you can't say Ernie Witt without saying Roseville's Ernie Witt, because every time he came back to play at Tiger Stadium in the 80s with the Jays, we'd go on TV or radio and say, hey, the Jays are in town. And last night, Roseville's Ernie Witt. He could not escape that. That was actually became his new first.
The irony is he never really left Detroit, and he could probably go anywhere in Metro Detroit, and not that many people are going to recognize him. Only Wayne Gretzky, maybe, or somebody like that is more popular in Canada than Ernie Witt. He's the head coach of the Canadian National Baseball Team, even, which I think is pretty cool. Anyway, I want to tell you folks about interest rates. You know that they're at record lows. close. So you should consider taking advantage of these market conditions to refinance your home with David Hall Mortgage. He's been a prominent voice in our community for over three decades, built his business and his reputation of leadership in the mortgage market by consistently offering the choices, options, and personal attention that separate him from all those mortgage factories you see and hear about in the media. It's why David Hall has so many thousands of satisfied clients. Hall Financial prides itself in keeping the process moving with a staff that consistently provides the fastest service in the business, generally 3 weeks or fewer. That's how you garner nearly 1,500 five-star reviews from Michigan homeowners. So you want to go to DavidHallMortgage.com, get started, or just call them on an easy number to remember, 248-308-5000. Hall Financial, lower payments, better options, and more personal attention. And Luke Nowacki delivers a lot of that too at Pinnacle Wealth Strategies. You know his name. We talk about him all the time. Hoping that you'll consider his credentials, expertise honed over decades as a financial advisor. It's allowed Luke to build a track record of success. He's helped families chart a path financially and then steadily, systematically guide them to financial independence. So let Luke help develop a new path for you or refine the one you're on. Set up a complimentary consultation. Doesn't cost anything. He's going to answer all your questions, then lay out a comprehensive plan for you to consider to fulfill all your financial goals. We feel confident promoting Luke because we've heard from his clients that he is highly ethical, caring, knowledgeable, and he'll always be there to adjust and suggest when market forces alter the landscape. Here's Luke's number, 248-663-4748, Luke Nowacki, Pinnacle Wealth Strategies. And you're listening to the No Filter Sports Podcast.
All right, I got a quick one for you. The Patriots named Cam Newton as the captain of the football team. You know why?
Because the quarterback should be.
No, nobody else wanted it.
Come on.
I don't know about that. All I want to know is how the hell is Belichick keep doing it year after year after day? Somebody actually referred to it on the anniversary of Vince Lombardi's death, which Eli mentioned on the last show. They referred to him on Twitter as the greatest coach who ever lived. I said, really? Where does Belichick rank then? Give me a break. And how does this, again, he gets Cam Newton? Seriously? I mean,
well, Cam Newton's just amazing.
If he stays healthy, they got a hell of a team.
Yeah,
they do.
And they needed a starting quarterback worse than any other team in football, so that makes perfect sense.
So you go out, it was a perennial Super Bowl contender. You don't have a high draft choice ever, okay? So you still go out and come down with one of the biggest names quarterbacks in the National Football League. It's just amazing. Do you guys see the Broncos have now become the latest NFL team to hire a woman?
I'm sorry, coach.
You just say you don't agree with it?
I don't get it. I just don't get it.
Well, let me tell you a little about her. Her name is Emily Zahler, and she had been, I guess, with the Knicks, so she got a ticket out of jail there. She is a certified strength and conditioning specialist. She worked with the Knicks until this past spring when the NBA, of course, closed down. So, I mean, look, this is a person. I mean, what, a woman can't be a qualified strength and conditioning coach? Why not? Why couldn't she know as much about that as a man?
It's not that I don't think she can, but I think it's, at least in the beginning, it's going to be a big distraction. It really is.
Depends what she looks like. So, I'm sorry.
Well, she looks pretty good.
I hate to be so crude, but that's
she looks pretty good. So
if she looks like Paige Spiranak, it's going to be a problem.
Okay. You know what? You're probably right.
Nobody looks like Paige Spearman.
Did you see a heartwarming NFL story that Jake Butt made the Broncos after overcoming his sixth knee operation?
Yeah, of course, former Michigan star tight end.
He screwed up his knee playing in that bowl game. Three seasons in Denver. He played in as many games as he had major knee surgeries. Three. He says, "I'm healthy. It's part of my story. I'm out here. I'm playing ball. I'm not looking back." And the irony again, before we move on, is that Michigan doesn't plan on playing football this year. However, right across the street, within a punt of Michigan Stadium, is Pioneer Field, and Pioneer will be playing. Gretchen Whitmer reopened football. Practice starts tomorrow, September 8th. But as of this time, no Big Ten football. But nope. I think it's going to happen at some point. You know, the Pac-12, also like Michigan, caught up in not playing for health reasons, says they are very close to working with a lab called Quidel that's going to have 15-minute tests with results. Yeah. And that as soon as
it's already September. They got to prepare. They got to get ready. So they could start the season when October 15th and play in January and February.
Bob, there's no clock on the season. I mean, they can come and go as often as they want.
There is a clock.
They got postponements
and
things like that.
You want to sit out in Ann Arbor on January 20th? You want to sit outside?
Yeah, you know what? Who cares? I mean, if people will, and eventually they're going to go to the ballpark.
You know, one thing we lose track of, and I've mentioned it 1,000 times, but I'll do it a little differently this time. It's all arbitrary.
Yeah.
It's all made up when the seasons are. Football is made up. We invented the game. It didn't. Yep. God didn't create football. We did, or baseball. So we make up the rules. We make up the schedules. We make up the teams. We make up the seasons. We make it all up. So all we're doing is we're a little more making it up than we usually do. Although, of course, usually it has the stamp of permanence and the way it has to be and the way it should be. It has to be 162 games. It has to be played now. Whereas it's all changeable. And so that's unfortunately what we're seeing in stark reality now, that it is all arbitrary. Yeah,
well, you used a lot of catchphrases there, such as arbitrary, making up rules as you go along. I do not want to accuse our beloved president of doing any of those things. But he did say over the weekend, he was asked for a quote on the Big Ten football situation. He said, I think they're going to play, and they can just go ahead and play without Michigan and Michigan State. That's what he said.
Well, that's okay. Well, he may not be the only
God,
other one.
God, you know, God may have created the first halftime show, burning the bush on the mount. You know,
as my buddy Bruce Cook said, when the coach was given the rules our senior year, no smoking, no this and that. You know, and Bruce said, well, if he meant us to play football, he would have given us a helmet. So how can you say what's right and what's wrong?
Yeah.
In any case, here we go.
Michigan State. Has a reputation, well-deserved one, of developing great kickers and great punters over the many years. Greg Montgomery might have been the greatest punter Michigan State ever had. All-pro as well, 9 years in the NFL. Played with the Lions for a little bit. Houston and Baltimore as well. It's just been revealed he died 2 weeks ago at the age of 55. He still holds the all-time conference record of 49.7 yards per punt. Says, what happened? What's going on? Suffering from severe depression for quite some time. Mm-hmm. They haven't announced it, but you know it was a suicide. Just such a terrible, terrible tragedy. Also, the former University of Michigan, University of Detroit basketball coach Dave Smokey Gaines died last week. I knew him very well. Dick Vitale was all over Twitter over the weekend talking about what Smokey meant to him and so on and so forth. And then Demetrius Gore, who was Michigan's Mr. Basketball, you know, back in the 80s, passed away playing playground ball here in New York somewhere the weekend before last. That got almost no publicity whatsoever. He was in his 50s as well. So it's just, man, it's depressing.
By the way,
every day you see all these deaths. My goodness.
By the way, Smokey was really a good guy.
He was, actually. Yes, that's an inside joke, folks. Danny was saying he didn't know who he was before the show started.
An inside joke. He had every justification to not know who he was, but we already had that conversation. Interesting, Novak Djokovic.
Yeah, isn't that something?
He's eliminated from the turn in frustration. He smashed a tennis ball without even looking back behind him, and it hit one of the lines judges in the throat. And now if he hadn't hit her in the throat, it might have been a warning, but no suspension, no knocked out, no eliminated from the tournament or fined. He could be fined up to $250,000 if it's considered aggravated behavior, because that's what his prize money would be for making it to the round of 14. But all the top
seats on his face. Did you see the look on his face when it happened?
Yeah.
He was just stunned and
crestfallen. It was
terrible. Now,
I don't know if you guys were watching yesterday, but I watched all the coverage in the aftermath on ESPN2, and McEnroe was on, both McEnroe brothers and so on and so forth. They interviewed the guy who's the head of the tennis federation, whatever it is, and he spelled it out in clear terms. Intent doesn't matter. Yep. It's anything like this that could occur.
Right.
It's automatic. It's in the tennis rule book, whatever that is, that you have to be suspended. And then later on Twitter, Greg Gaynor, one of our listeners and fans, was pointing out, he found this information from another site. At the French Open in 2016, Nove had a very testy exchange with the media because he had thrown his racket in a match. And the media said, well, how long are you going to keep going like this before they suspend you? And they thought you scoffed at him. Nah, nothing like this is ever going to happen to me. How about that? Just four years ago.
What's fascinating about the rules where intent doesn't matter. I don't know about that. Intent should matter. But how about tennis in the Grand Slams is the only sport where you can't coach your player.
Boxers so ridiculous. You want to go on about the stuff that's wrong with tennis or golf.
I mean, coaching is part of sports. All sports that we watch, the ball sports, coaching goes on all game long, before the game, during the game, after the game. And in tennis, you can't say, a coach can't yell to a player, you're leaning left on your serve, or you need to throw the ball up higher. Why that is? Who knows?
But they do give signs to each other. I mean, between the player
to.
And the
no, they're not supposed
they're
to, Jenny.
Supposed to, but you can see them doing it the entire match. Oh,
Serena got caught sure with that. And she was so upset in the 2018 U.S. Open, and later on, her coach admitted he did make signals to her.
Yeah, I was going to say something to add to that about some of the tennis rules and coaching and so on and so forth. But I mean, there are a lot of things wrong with that sport. But everybody's saying, and I think they're right. We got to say goodbye to our radio listeners. But the matches have been great at the U.S. Open. You don't even notice as much that there aren't any fans there.
And by the way, we're going to say goodbye to our radio listeners. And here's my challenge, okay? If you listen to WCWA and you listen to this show, let us know. I want one person from Toledo to write on the 76089 balls or asknofilter@gmail.com and say, yes, I listen.
Hang on a minute.
If we get nothing, they're done.
There's a whole sheriff's department.
They're done. It's over.
There's an entire sheriff's department that listens to this show.
And have him write it to prove it. Have him prove it.
All right. And he will because he listens to every word, every moment. So yeah, I will call him today.
Brandon's going nuts.
And you know what? Wait for this show. These guys wait for this
show. We're going to say goodbye to WCWA, hopefully not for the last time. They've been listening to the No Filter Sports Podcast.
Don't you dare, because I'll get a ticket down there.
You're never going to get a ticket down there, and I don't think Eli or I would be getting a ticket there either.
Hey, Feldman Automotive is Michigan's number one Chevy dealer. 5 locations, Nova, New Hudson, Lansing, Livonia, Highland. Feldman has 9 locations at all. Feldman Hyundai of New Hudson, Kia of Novi, Dodge, Jeep, and Ram of Woodhaven. And perhaps their biggest store, and the one that really is just sets them apart, is this pre-owned supercenter in Waterford, known nearly simply as 1-800-PRE-OWNED. You can buy a fully inspected and guaranteed pre-owned auto from Feldman and get the exclusive, check this out, drive it for 3 days, love it, or bring it back. It's a guarantee with a kicker. Their exclusive guaranteed credit approval. Think of that. Guaranteed credit approval. Go get the car. You don't like it, bring it back. Start all over again. Hey, we're proud and confident you can find what you want at any one of Feldman's 9 locations. Let them earn your business. At the same time, support us. No Filter Sports. You can also buy online at FeldmanAuto.com. It's hassle-free at home or in the showroom. Encourage you to also consider Power Home Solar. This is America's fastest growing solar energy company, making all their panels right here in America. And with solar energy, you know what you do. You save money, you save the environment, and you help yourself avoid infuriating power outages, because Power Home Solar is partnering with Generac, which is the nation's largest provider of in-home backup battery and generator systems. So no more power outages. You get a sustainable solution for your in-home energy. Lower your energy bills and eliminate power outages forever. Power Home Solar has financing starting at just $99 a month. Call them at 1-800-POWER-90. Save an additional $1,800. Support our guys. They'll continue to support us, and we can continue to do the No Filter Sports Podcast. Well, on this day... Well, yesterday, this is September 7th, September 6th, Cal Ripken played in he broke the record, 21-31, breaking Lou Gehrig's hallowed record for consecutive games. The current record, Whit Merrifield, he had 285 going into the weekend. As Cal Ripken said recently, if I can do it, somebody else can. It just takes 17 years without missing a game. Wound up at 2,632.
Nothing to it.
Finally took himself out in 90 and 98. But in 90, though, and this is a real controversy. Do you guys remember this? He was slumping. He was hitting like 209 in mid-June. Frank Robinson was the manager, thought about benching him several times, but never did it. And he hung in there with him. He hit 250, picked it up the second half of the year. But then the next year in 91, career highs, MVP, 323, 34 homers, 114 RBIs. What I remember most about Cal Ripken was that he and Paul Molitor and Robin Yount were great Hall of Fame shortstops that really blocked Alan Trammell from getting the recognition that he deserved at the time.
I don't know, Eli. They didn't block Barry Larkin. You know what I'm saying? Do you think Trammell was as good as Ripken? You know, I love Tram. You know that, but I don't think so.
Well taken. Ripken turned 60 last month. He had prostate cancer, had surgery, though, in March, and he is doing okay. So Cal Ripken, 25 years ago today in 1995. Let's see. What else do we have here? Hey, on today, this day in 1979, ESPN made its debut and changed the landscape of sports
for sure
forever. 1939, Bob Feller, 20. Youngest pitcher to win 20 games. Denny, I looked it up. You won 20 in 66, but you were 22 at the time. Not that far behind Bob Feller, the youngest ever to win 20. And he was one of my favorites, not when he was with the Phillies, but he was an original Met. I'm talking about Richie Ashburn. And on this day in 1954, with a 3-2 count, he fouled off the next 14 pitches and finally drew a walk. The great Richie Ashburn.
Was that the late Dave Bergman? Was it Roy Lee Howell of Toronto?
Yes.
Remember that? I was there. I don't know how many pitches that was.
That was a 13-pitch at-bat. He had a 3-run homer in that game. Went into an extras. You remember who? I asked you this question, and you know the answer. Who hit the 3-run homer earlier in the game that to help send it into extra innings? It was third baseman Howard Johnson.
Oh, it was. I was going to say.
Howard Johnson. My goodness.
I'd like to get Hojo on the phone, but man,
I've called Hojo and left.
He's scared to talk. He's a good guy.
I don't know what his problem is.
He's scared he's going to offend somebody, but I really like Hojo. I went way back with Hojo. Let's see what else. Oh, doubleheader. This is interesting because we talked with Bill Lee about this when he was on not long ago. When the Red Sox collapsed in 1978, the Yankees were 14 games back. The Red Sox were on 111 win pace. And then this weekend was called the Boston Massacre. The Yankees went to Boston, beat the Red Sox 15-3, 13-2. They swept them out, scoring 42-9. It was the beginning of the end. Yankees were struggling, injuries, controversies. They had an alcoholic manager, Billy Martin, Reggie Jackson, you know, getting in trouble all the time, George Steinbrenner. They made up all those games, and it was the Boston Massacre. By the way, Bill Lee, was part of that 13 runs and 17 hits given up in one of those games.
And by the way, if some of you people out there are just kind of joining us, Bill Lee was our guest on this program some time ago. You go on our website, obviously nofiltersportspodcast.com. You can hear our interview with Bill Lee, and yes, it was entertaining.
One of the most thrilling interviews I ever did was to finally meet Arthur Ashe. Back in the 80s, he came through town. I was at Channel 4 at the time, and I did a half-hour interview with him. I wish I had saved it. He didn't die that much longer after that. He probably already was infected with HIV at the time through a transfusion. But it was on this day in 1968 that he won the U.S. Open, the first African-American to win a Grand Slam tournament.
I did a lot of stuff with Arthur Ashe.
Just one note to add to Arthur Ashe. The same people that did his auction are going to do my auction in October.
That's right. The first weekend
company,
in October.
Yeah. Nice.
Just like you, Eli, I had a number of dealings with Arthur Ashe. I even went to his funeral at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in Manhattan. A finer man in sports you would never meet than Arthur Ashe.
Yep. Agreed. Got nothing bad to say about Arthur Ashe? He didn't stick.
There was more work for Brandon bad to say about you and Denny McClain, but no, not about Arthur Ashe. I don't.
Okay, go ahead. How about the bag?
Here's the mailbag. You can tweet any of us, though Eli and Denny are way too big to respond to you guys. You can tweet them at Eli Zerit, at MU2Denny, and I do respond to all you guys at Bob Page Sports. James Harris just finished listening to the last show. Was it great? Shep was an awesome guest. I could have listened to another few hours of that interview. So great to see a local kid earn his way into a great job. Considering that it's the Detroit Tigers, he still manages to make it interesting every night. And yet here comes an unnamed texter who says the criticism of Shep and Jim Price is, quote, priceless. It's much needed and it's overdue. We deserve better announcers. Scott Plachta responds, great episode Thursday with Shep. I remember him as a very, I didn't know this. I remember him as a very negatively opinionated WDFN radio host. Back then, I felt he was a little over the top for my liking. Thanks for asking the tough questions to him, Bob. He's softened up quite a bit and become a company man like Jim Price. Oh, by the way, when is Jim Price coming on? Why is he missing games? I don't know. And Scott, I'd like to have Jim on if we could.
He was on yesterday. I heard. In fact, it was the first radio I listened to with the Tigers, and it is weird with no sound. Yeah. Like two guys in a soundproof booth whispering to each other. That was bizarro.
Yeah. Scott Plachta also wanted to add, and I'm going to defend my buddy on this one. Eli, obviously you've never been to Mount Pleasant. Dick Enberg went to CMU. Mm-hmm. You thought of Terry Foster in regards to broadcasting at Central Michigan before Dick Enberg? But really? You know what? I didn't mention Dick either. It's just off the cuff.
I mentioned my buddies. Dave Llewellyn, Freddie Heumann.
And we mentioned all those guys.
Yeah.
Paul Carey and so on and so forth. Here's something interesting from David Jones, listener, who got to us at asknofilter@gmail.com. So David says, I would never tell you three guys not to speak your mind or how to think, but perhaps only to maybe consider a different point of view. Personally, I was a bit disheartened to hear your near condemnation of the protest around sports in support of social causes. Your message seemed to be basically show up, do your job, and keep personal and social issues out of the locker room. You are asking them to disregard their sincere feelings, something very important to a great
We never said them. Anything
That's
like
a great,
that.
With all due respect, as Dave Jones has written us many times, loyal listener, all I said was that I talked about guilty while driving black. We talked about it earlier in the show. What I said, which may have been controversial, I don't think so, is that I hate to see the violence destroy the message, and I hate to see a guy like Blake, who may not be an upstanding individual, become the face of the movement. It hurts the movement. I support BLM altogether. I just don't support the violence and the excess. That's all.
I'm here in New York City, and I took a lot on a long walk on Sunday afternoon. I took a lot of pictures, and you go down south of me, like on 7th Avenue, you see plate glass windows of famous stores broken out, and they're boarded up. And then the kids came along and put the Black Lives Matter slogans after the windows they had smashed in New York City.
That's shameful.
In the BLM movement.
That is ruining a well-meaning, a well-timed,
yes,
important movement. Ruining
Absolutely.
It.
Can't be tolerated.
Brian Fusen is back with us. We haven't heard from him in quite a while. He's a mailman. He thinks it's time to contribute to the mailbag. Says he's reading Roger Craig's book from 84, Inside Pitch. Although Craig was a great pitching coach, he also sat next to Sparky on the bench, relaying signs he was stealing from the other team, talking strategy. So all this leads me to wonder, says Brian, why, and Denny can address this, why are the Tigers keeping Rick Anderson on as pitching coach? He's been with Gardy forever. I understand maybe the strategy angle, but it doesn't seem like he's had much success molding young pitchers outside of Johan Santana in Minnesota. If these young guys like Casey Mize and Joe Jimenez are not improving under his tutelage, how much rope do you give Rick Anderson? He says his patience is wearing thin, and he says the Tigers, and I agree with him here, made a horrible decision in firing Chris Bosio.
Well, the problem with the manager, excuse me, and the pitching coach is that they're normally friends, and managers bring friends with them to the major leagues, with few exceptions like Johnny Sain. Johnny Sain was hired as an independent type of guy, and boy, he was independent because he would tell the manager, you know, go F yourself. You're not going to hurt my pitchers. But that's the problem. Historically, the manager brings the pitching coach with him who's been a friend for 20 years, and that's how they wind up with their jobs. Whether they can teach anything or not, I don't understand it. But right now, we got a problem with that ball club when it comes to teaching how to pitch.
I got two names for you. Billy Martin, Art Fowler.
Yeah, about, there you go.
I got three names for you for Sparky.
Drinking Trusky, buddies.
Consolo and Gramis.
Yeah.
And so sure. Those were his buddies. And the four utility infielders,
right,
all had a bond. Yeah.
But together they didn't play 30 games in their career.
It's funny how all the Tigers pitchers and catchers were just, they thought Chris Bosio was the greatest thing since sliced
bread.
And then he lost his job in a ridiculous PC thing in the locker room.
You know, I forget that it was an off-color comment that was veiled.
Right, yeah. I got a couple more, and that's all, Eli. Don't worry about it. Tom Bell, writing from Chicago, again, big fan. And he says, I know it's tough navigating through the balance of politics with sports, but you guys do a great job of it. Try to get the show on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, 3 a week, and we get that all the time from people. And he says, what I most enjoy about the show, good coverage of current sports, but you also reflect back on Detroit sports history. Fantastic interviews, Denny's arbitrary statistics, your great golf coverage, family-friendly with no profanity, Eli's This Day in Sports. You don't have any callers, live callers, objective views, no pandering, and, of course, he adds,
the mailbag.
Capitalized.
My special
capitalized,
favorite.
Yes.
And then we also want to give you the phone number if you'd like to call and leave a message for us or text us. You can do so at 760-89-BALLS. And Dave Hockman is writing from one of the two places he lives, Ann Arbor or Phoenix. And he says, I believe Eli was talking about a white running back from Penn State on the last show. Of course, he met John Cappelletti. And Bob, you were mistaken when you said that Tony Dorsett beat out Lorenzo White for the Heisman Trophy. Dorsett won the trophy in 1976.
We corrected you on that. Yeah,
many years. Yeah, well, the thing, I just read that somewhere, but, you know, I've known Dave Hockman for a long time. You can't get anything past this guy, especially about Michigan football.
Bo Jackson and Tim Brown were the two guys that beat out Lorenzo.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, Eli, how about you introduce our special guest today, Detroit's
own. Let's do it. Let's get to it. Ernie Witt was born in the shadow of Tiger Stadium. As a young boy, the Witts moved to the suburbs, and every time Ernie's Blue Jays came to Detroit in the 80s, he was referred to by all of us in the media as Roseville's Ernie Witt. So proud were we of the native son. After an eight-year minor league struggle, he'd become an all-star and eventually be considered the best catcher in Jays history. And in 87, he and the Jays made history, hitting a still-standing 10 homers in a single game with Ernie's blast, his third of the night against the Orioles, shattering the old mark.
3-1 pitch. Gone. Home run. Ernie Witt, three home runs in a game. And Exhibition Stadium is going bonkers. Ernie Witt takes a bow, well deserved. New major league record. Nine home runs in a game.
That's right. The Phillies eventually got 9-99, but the record of 10 still stands. Ernie joins us now. Ernie, to come from Detroit and come back and play in Detroit, you always start at Tiger Stadium. I know you wanted to get drafted by the Tigers. How do you look back on it? You're in Detroit now. I guess you've gotten over the fact that you never got to play for your hometown team, huh?
Eli, I have to say, it was a little bit of a disappointment. You know, as you said, I grew up a Tiger fan. I used to go down and watch Denny pitch and, Norm Cash, Bill Freeland, and Bill Freehan, and Al Kaline. I mean, my gosh, it was.
You better say Denny McClain.
Watch back
he did.
Then.
You
he
better
did.
Add Denny McClain there, Ernie.
He said him first, by the way. He said him first.
So, yeah, it was a disappointment. Even I think it was in 86 when the owners were colluding against us. I went to the Tigers and said, look, just pay me what I made last year. And they said, no, we couldn't do it. So, I mean, it was disappointing, but it always inspired me to come to Tiger Stadium and hit in that ballpark.
Did you run into Campbell then trying to come to the ball club? Was Campbell the guy?
I think it was
Bill LaJoy.
Bill LaJoy, maybe.
Yeah, Billy. Okay.
Yeah, I believe it was Bill LaJoy.
Well, good collusion, guy. Collusion, and ugly. In fact, yeah. That same year they had lost Lance Parrish, who was their starting catcher. So you probably figured, well, I'll fill in for Lance, but they weren't giving anybody any money.
Well, then you made a lot of money on that too, Ernie. You were part of that collusion lawsuit, weren't you?
Yeah, I wouldn't say I made a lot of money, Bob, but I did okay. You know.
They were
holding the salaries down at that point in time.
Yeah.
Talk about you come up and, by the way, did you play against Essien and Gump? Because they had Essien on the show a couple of months ago. It seems like you guys were kind of contemporaries.
Yeah, we played. Jimmy was basically in the National League, I think, with the Cubs and the Phillies quite a bit.
No, I meant growing up in Detroit is what I meant.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure we did down in the Detroit leagues, yes.
You know, you didn't make it till the major leagues until you're about or a regular until you're about 28. You struggled many, many years in the minor leagues. And I find it so interesting because when Denny wrote the book together, Sharon, when Denny was 18, he was going to give up when the White Sox cut him. And before the Tigers called, she said, look, I don't want to be married to somebody. They're going to get married who doesn't want to continue with your career, that you don't give up. You had the same problem too. Your wife several times had to pull you back from the brink. Were you really close after the first time when the Red Sox wouldn't play you and you've been in the minors 3 or 4 years, then it happened again later. What was that drama like? And when you look back on the fact that you didn't quit and she convinced you to give it another try.
Yeah, it was, with the Red Sox, there was a pretty good excuse why I wasn't playing. There was a guy there by the name of Carlton Fisk.
Yeah.
And he kind of was blocking a lot of the young catchers coming up through the Red Sox system. So when the expansion draft came in November of 76, and I was taken by Toronto, I really thought that, you know, that was going to give me my opportunity and shot. And I played a little bit in 77 in Toronto, and 78 a September call-up. Then I was sent down, and I guess it was in 79, in the spring training in 79, and the manager at that point in time said that I had to go and work on my defense. It wasn't
Roy Hartsfield at the time.
That was right, Roy Hartsfield. And actually, the uncanny part about it, and it happens in baseball a lot, I threw out three out of the four guys that day. We were playing the Cardinals, and they had some guys that could run a little bit. And I threw out three of the four, and he calls me in after the game, says, you got to go down and work on your defense. Jeez. And it's like, okay, this is – it's just not going to work. So halfway through the 79 season, I was playing in Syracuse, New York, with our AAA club, and I got a call from Pat Gillick, and said that there's going to be some changes made just to kind of hang tough. And so in 79, I never played in the big leagues.
You were one of the first Toronto Blue Jays to up it there. And then in the original group, you were the last guy still, 11 years later, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, my last year playing was 89 with the Blue Jays. I just felt I tricked them for a lot of years, Dave.
Who was the best pitcher you ever caught?
I would have to say Dave Steeb.
Really?
Yeah, I would say it would be him. Of course, when I went to Atlanta in 1990, I had Smoltzy, I had Glavin. You know, those guys are pretty good too. But as far as raw stuff, I would say it was Dave Steeb.
I have a friend of mine from BC originally, and she's a big sports fan, a big baseball fan. To her, the sun rose and set on the Toronto Blue Jays, because other than Montreal, there was no other Major League Baseball team there. So you're almost a god throughout Canada. You're one of the most popular athletes in Canadian history, yet you came back to Detroit to live every year in the offseason.
Well, you know, this was home, and home is home. And actually, I think sometimes it's easier coming back and living at home than instead of living in Toronto, because mm-hmm. As you said, I was well known, and it was really tough to go and do anything without being recognized in Toronto, where I could come back to Roseville or Clinton Township and no one knew me. So it was kind of nice.
Well, you know, I can see why you feel such a tight relationship with this area. Your family, your father brought the family up from Virginia looking for work. He was a truck driver. You grew up right by Tiger Stadium, and then you moved out to Roseville, I guess, when the family could afford it. So the fact is, you are Detroit. Detroit made you, and just to think of it, you grew up in the shadow of Tiger Stadium. We didn't mention that earlier, although you probably don't remember those days. So all the more that it tugged your heartstrings, but you hit so well against the Tigers. You killed them. I forget. I don't have the stats in front of me, but
I bet Ernie knows them.
Yeah, but you constantly were a Tiger killer. How does that happen? Can it really be the extra adrenaline you feel? Was it the fact that you wish you'd been here and couldn't? Why did you play so well against the Tigers?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know. I guess the fact that, you know, I knew I had family and friends watching, and the fact that I kind of wanted to prove them wrong too. You know, I mean, it was like, you know, you made a statement against me saying that, you know, I would never, and this goes back to early years before I was even drafted by the Red Sox. Some of their scouts said that I'd never make it, you know, past AA baseball in the minor leagues. And so I guess it's just trying to prove a point that, you know, I was kind of a blue collar type of worker, and I was going to try to do everything I can to make it and stay in the big leagues.
We all leave the game with injuries. Have you got any sustaining injuries from getting up and down so many damn times?
Just bad knees. Yeah. You know, I can no longer run. I walk. I enjoy walking, but you know, they've been after me to have replacements for the last 10 years. And I tell them I just don't have time to do it, because I'm still very much involved in baseball. And to get knee replacements, you're going to be down for, you know, 5 to 6 months anyway. So,
Well, that's why
until I retire.
Yeah, that's where I was going with my next question. You're so popular in Canada that you're actually the head coach of the Canadian national baseball team. You've done that for a while. You've coached them in the Olympics. You've coached them in the World Tournament. Tell us about your role and how it came about, and whether you're enjoying working with these kids.
Man, that's been a blast, Bob. I mean, it's been, you know, I started, they asked me in 1999 if I'd be interested in coaching the Canadian national team. And I think the way it came about is that they were having maybe identity problems, and the fact that they thought that they could get someone that had somewhat of a name throughout Canada would help with that identity. And of course, in 99, we had the Pan American Games in Winnipeg, Ontario, Winnipeg, Alberta. Alberta? No, Winnipeg.
Winnipeg's Manitoba. In Manitoba.
Manitoba. And it was in Winnipeg.
You do live in Detroit, don't you?
Yes. And we ended up beating the United States and winning a gold, bronze medal anyways in the Pan Am Games. And that was basically the start of it. And from that point on, you know, I've gone over and managed with them. And like you said, in the Olympics, which was outstanding in 2004, a number of world championships, which has given me the ability to travel the country. I mean, it's been outstanding. It's a great organization. And with that, it kind of fed into managing the WBC teams on the Canadian side, too, which we haven't fared very well.
Yeah.
But it's been a lot of fun to do. And, you know, you get these Canadians are different, man. I'm telling you. They are different. They will.
Oh, yeah.
Beyond the beer. It's beyond the beer.
Oh, we will definitely drink beer. There's no question about that. We will party hard off the field, but we will play hard on the field.
Yeah. Well, any of your kids make it to the big leagues yet from these past Canadian national teams?
Oh, yeah, there's been, yeah, well, Justin Morneau.
Morneau was, wow, was yeah. You really? Him too.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. There's been a few that's
but not Joey Votto. That's before your time, I think.
Joey Votto was before my time? Well, I've got him in the WBCs, yeah.
Oh, so you have coached Joey Votto then, too.
Yeah.
Interesting, yeah.
Well, your last full season was 89. By then, you were in the expansion draft in 76. You stayed with the team longer than anybody else that was from the beginning of the Blue Jays operations. Your last full season was 89. You're 37. One of the last homers you hit came against the Red Sox in Boston, the team that drafted you and gave up on you. The Jays trailed 10-0 going into the seventh, battled back to 10-7 at the top of the ninth, when, yes, Ernie faced the great reliever Lee Smith.
Whoa! Tears. If fair. It is. Sutter. Gone. Grand slam. Can't believe it. Jays have turned this game upside down. Went as grand slam the Red Sox.
Turns out they won the game in extra innings after coming back from 10-0. By the way, I looked it up. 23 homers you hit against the Tigers, nearly 20% of your career totals, 73 RBIs against them also. But, you stayed with it thanks to Chris, your wife, encouraging you. You went on to become one of the great Canadian players of all time. How do you look back on the career? What do you want to be remembered for? Was it the perseverance? Was it the fact that Bill James called you one of the top catchers, maybe in Canadian, or 72nd best catcher in history? What do you take with the game? What's your legacy as far as you see it?
I don't know, Eli. I want, hopefully the fans remember that I played hard every time I hit an opportunity. I never took a pitch off, which is very difficult to do. As you know, I mean, this game is a very difficult game to play. And the fact that I was able to play as long as I did, I played after I left the Jays, I went to Atlanta in 1990 and then Baltimore in 91. So, but there always comes a time when you know your number's up and it's time to move on and get out. But I was, I just tried to give back to the community. Like I said, the Canadian fans were tremendous supporters of myself and my family. And, but again, I guess the biggest thing is that, I wasn't a superstar. I just tried to show up and do my job.
one of the people you worked with was one of the greatest gentlemen I ever met in my life, Sam Mealy, who managed Minnesota Twins and a number of other teams. He looks like he had something to do with turning your hitting around.
I tell you what, I have so many good thoughts about Sam. He kind of, you know, when you break into the minor leagues, you have to be in the right place at the right time and the right eyes looking at you, because there's so many good ball players down in the minor leagues. But if you don't have that person that has a little bit of pull working with you and pulling for you, you know, you could get lost in the shuffle. And Sam kind of took me under his wing, and he liked the way I was swinging the bat. Of course, he was the hitting guy at that time. He kind of looked after me and tried to put me in good positions. And I absolutely have always thought the world of Sam.
I want to mention another major league manager here, and that's John Gibbons. You're on Gibbons' coaching staff with the Blue Jays. He was in a little trouble, looked like they were going to make a move, and everybody across Canada is writing, they got the manager right on the staff. Ernie Witt's going to be elevated to this position, and they didn't give it to you. Is that the greatest disappointment of your life?
It would be, yes. I would have to say, and I've said this all along, I said, you know, you've got the best manager. I'm the best manager that's never been hired to manage. Again, it's a difficult job. Gibby's a good manager. He's a good people person. The players love playing for him. I thought he handled the pitching staff extremely well. I was a disappointment. But then again, you look back and, you know, maybe if I would have been given the opportunity to manage, you know, maybe the team would have stunk, and all of a sudden Ernie Witt stinks, and all of a sudden the profile that you created during your playing career is shot. And I think that might have happened a little bit to Alan Trammell in Detroit. You know, he didn't have a very good team to manage. And I don't know whether the fans don't think highly enough of him anymore. Tremendous ball player, but didn't have the success as a manager.
You're not an old man. You're 68. Are you somewhere in the back of your mind hoping maybe I will get a chance?
No. Believe me, I'm very content with what I'm doing. Every game that I watch, in which, you know, up until this year, you know, we're going to minor league games and big league games all the time, I'm sitting there evaluating our catchers. But I'm also still managing too. You know, well, if I was a manager, I'd do this, I'd do that. But I think the fact that the time that I managed with the Canadian team is good enough for me right now. I mean, this is a young man's game now. Yeah. You know, most of the managers, the GMs, I mean, they're in their, you know, early 30s, and you know, none of them pushing 40 very often. So. You know, it's time to pass, and it's time for other people to take over.
Let's go back to when you were in your early 30s. You're 32, in fact, in 84. In those years there, 84, 85, and then again 87, the Tigers and the Jays were tremendous ball clubs. You had George Bell and Steve, who you mentioned, Mosby, Alfredo Griffey, just a really incredible young players that would eventually have their day. 84, of course, no chance, because the Tigers go 35-5. 85, you do beat them. And in 87, that one, I wonder if that one still sits in your craw, because you led by 3.5 games, 7 to play. You collide with Paul Molitor and break 2 ribs at the very end of the season, the 29th. You struggled to play in that final series that ended, of course, with Tanana winning 1-0. What are your recollections of that, and maybe the disappointment in 87 of not being able to win it again?
You know, Eli, I say all along that the 87 team I thought was our best team that I ever played on. You know, and yes, it haunts me to this day. You know, we won 97 games, but then we lost our final 7 games of the series. We lost Tony Fernandez a week where Madlock took him out at second base. So we lost him for the final 8 days of the season. Like you said, I ran into Molitor, his knee kind of collided with my ribs, and so I missed the last 4 games of the season. And the tough part, we were at Tiger Stadium and we were playing, we just needed 1 win, and we didn't do it. So again, that was very disappointing because I really felt that we would have gone on and played Minnesota. And I believe that year we had a real good record against Minnesota. So, you know, I thought it was a lost opportunity, but injuries are a part of the game also.
Did you have many dramatic explosions at the plate?
I've had a few collisions at the plate, absolutely.
What was the worst?
Probably Don Baylor kind of set me up a little bit, but he let up a little bit, otherwise it would have hurt. But I know that the one Rick Dempster told me with Bo Jackson, Bo ran him over the week before, and he came into Toronto. He says, Ernie, whatever you do, get out of that match. That's pretty good. So I took the advice that he gave me on that one.
Hey, Ernie, living in Detroit still, as you do, I'm sure you must be watching the Tigers. What are your impressions so far of the Detroit Tigers and of what's happened to baseball with this kind of bastardized version we're seeing?
Well, the little bit I've seen, you know, they've got a pretty good young club right now, and they're in a pretty good place. They're winning. They've got playing competitive ball from what I've seen. Again, I'm not seeing all of their games because, again, I'm kind of focusing on Philadelphia. But they looks like they've got some pretty good arms coming out of the bullpen late in the game, which you've got to have. If you work hard for, you know, eight innings, you want to have that guy come in that can get those final outs for you.
And about, again, the bastardized version of baseball with the runner on second to start extra innings and seven-inning doubleheaders, blah, blah, blah.
Well, I'm kind of used to that with international play because that's what we do in international play. If you're tied at the end of the game, we put a runner at first and second and go from there. But, you know, I don't like it at the major league level. At the minor league level, I don't mind it because, again, you know, once you get past the 11th inning, basically you're running short on pitching.
Yep.
Now you're seeing position players going out there to throw, and as it really becomes a game at that point in time. So, again, I think in the minor leagues, I think you could play for ties and get a half a point or whatever it is. But at the big league level, no, I don't like the runner on second base and the seven-inning games.
Ernie, that's sacrilegious, ties.
Like kissing your sister.
I know it is, but yeah. I'm saying in the minor leagues, not in the big leagues.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah, hey, Ernie, not in the big leagues, no.
Have you been guilty of blasphemy all these years living in Canada? Are you no longer a Wings fan and you want the Leafs to beat them whenever they play?
You know what? I'm one of those guys that will wear a jersey that half is Red Wings, half is Maple Leafs. growing up, I watched more Maple Leafs than I did.
We all did Hockey Night in Canada every Saturday night.
Hockey Night in Canada every Saturday night.
Yes, sir. And
until the Red Wings started putting their games on TV.
Yep.
And once they did that, then I watched all of the Wings games.
Yeah. You mentioned Philadelphia. Had you mentioned what specifically you're doing for the Phillies now?
No, I haven't. I've been with the Phillies now the last 11 years. I'm their catching coordinator. So I handle all the catchers in the minor leagues in our Dominican Republic Academy. I'm with the big club during spring training and the spring training 2.0. So but once they break, then I go and I take care of all the catchers in the minor leagues. We have about 32 catchers in our system, a lot of catchers.
So are you still doing all this traveling in the minor leagues and what have you?
Yes, yes.
Oh, my God. Oh, man. Lord almighty.
Well, let me ask you this then, because you mentioned going to Tiger Stadium and watching Denny and watching Bill Freehan and everybody. In your lifetime, who are the greatest catchers that you've ever seen? In other words, from Freehan on, you played against some great catchers, Ted Simmons, teammates, et cetera, et cetera. What do you think is the most important thing? A catcher, how do you evaluate them? And who do you think are the greatest you ever saw?
Well, I think the greatest that I ever saw play, I never really played against them other than spring training, was Johnny Bench. You know, you look at Pudge Rodriguez. I mean, he's pretty good catcher there also. But evaluation, it's basically, you know, receiving the ball, throwing the ball, blocking the ball, handling a pitching staff. You know, are they able to make in-game adjustments with the pitchers that are out on the mound? So those are some of the things that I look at with our catchers.
And then finally from me, last question, Ernie, how did you come to initially don the tools?
Yes,
of ignorance.
I was going to
why did you become a catcher? And why did you want to be one?
Hardest position.
No, well, that's a good story. Back when I was 7 years old, my brother was 2 years older. I mean, he was playing on a team. They needed a catcher. Well, the age limit for that was you had to be at least 8 years old. So I had to get special permission. But the only place they had was being a catcher. So the fact that I used to catch my brother all the time in the backyard, I became a catcher at that point in time.
A lot of managers were catchers because you really have to have a feel for the entire game. It's almost like quarterback in football, one of those positions that takes more than just playing your own. Well, Ernie, a great life in baseball. Great to have covered you all those years. Glad you're still in it and enjoying it. And thanks for being our guest today. We really appreciate it.
Great to see you today, Ernie. Thank you very much.
Great seeing all of you guys. Okay. You guys take care, stay safe, and go Tigers and Phillies.
All right.
Thanks, Ernie.
Stay safe.
Meeting the World Series. All right, Ernie Witt.
Thanks, Ernie.
Quite a life in baseball, you know, and I love the fact that, like you, Denny, there's so many times where it just seems it's such a difficult game. It's based on failure. Yep. Look at all the catchers, Rick Cerrone, Alan Ashby, Greg Myers, Pat Borders, that were pushed ahead of him. You have to fight through, maintain a self-belief. And I didn't ask him what he tells young players, but, you know, you'd think you'd want to discourage a guy you don't think can make it all the way. But then look at him. Look at how much discouragement he had. And he still went on to have a great career. So,
you know, and he did have a distinct advantage. I mean, I'm surprised he didn't play more and more and more. Although he played a lot, he didn't play the maximum amount of games he could have played because he was a left-handed hitter. That's a big deal for a left-handed hitting catcher in the major leagues, believe me.
I want to thank you guys for coming on. We don't know yet, but we'll have somebody really good for you on Thursday. And Mr.
Zaret is set up Doug English. Oh, yeah, that's what you're talking about, Doug English.
Yeah.
You're coming on next Monday, a week from today, the former Lion defensive lineman.
No, I think he's going to come on Thursday. I think
he is going to come on. Whatever.
When I talked to him on Monday. When did I do? No, today is Monday. When I talked to him on Thursday,
Some Prevagen.
I said this time next week. So I think Doug English is this Thursday. Yes.
Why don't you make sure on behalf of all of us?
You confuse me.
I'm just trying to say goodbye to everybody and get off the show here, damn it.
Well, because Doug English, who was, by the way, on the all-time Lions team. Anybody who's voted for, Doug English was a DT on the all-time Lions team, played 11 years here and went through how many coaches? Let's see. Forzano, Hudspeth, who was at the end?
Fonts
and Clark. I think three or four. In any case, great career with the Lions, all-time team, and Doug will be our guest on Thursday. I'm almost 100% sure. Let's hear from you in Toledo, okay? And we'll talk about it later on No Filter Sports.